You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Well, welcome everybody, and I'm glad you made it despite the rain, and I know it's also a podcast, so there are others watching. It's a great pleasure and honor to welcome Branko Milanović and his new book. There are other books, but this is his brand new one. And I've known Branko, I won't make very long introductions, but just to say that Branko is right now senior scholar at the Luxembourg Income Studies Center and visiting presidential professor at the Graduate Center at CUNY. He has all his life resisted just being a world banker or an international bureaucrat, but he has been a world banker. But also he's always remained an academic, an intellectual, a debater, and he's always, when you look at the details of his life, has navigated that not so easy kind of balance between working in a big institution and going back to teach and do some real academic research. And he's, I think, one of the best examples of that. And he's, of course, well known for his work on income distribution from many angles, and that's the topic of today. We're very lucky to have our own colleague Carol Graham with us today, who is the Leo Pasvolsky Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution and also College Park Professor at the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland and a Research Fellow at the Institute for the Study of Labor, ISA. Carol has been leading Brookings in many, many kind of different positions, heading different departments, is also a real academic, but deeply into policy, as you know. And she is probably one or two or three world leaders in measuring things somewhat differently than in terms of human progress than just GDP numbers or income numbers. Her book, The Pursuit of Happiness Towards an Economy of Well-Being, which was published in 2011, has really become a classic. And we're very, very happy to have Carol with us to give her perspective from her approach, also from her side, to the topic of income distribution. And finally, we've got Eduardo Porter. I really, really, Eduardo, I'm very grateful to you to have come down from New York, not just one floor across the street. Eduardo writes the economic scene column for the New York Times. Formerly, he was a member of the Times editorial board, where he wrote about business, economics, and other matters. He is a global person, as far as I can tell. He is born in Phoenix, but grew up in the United States, Mexico, and Belgium. He was a correspondent in Tokyo and London. In 1996, he moved to Sao Paulo, Brazil, as editor of America Economia, a business magazine. So many, many other things, he's one of those writers who has dealt with this topic and many other topics from a very global perspective as well as from an American perspective. So I'm really pleased to have you all here. Branko is going to give his overview, and then we'll, I'm sure, have a lively discussion. Branko will take about 10, 15 minutes, and usually we don't encourage PowerPoints, so there are no PowerPoints. But you all know his incredible diagram. I don't know whether he said he would kind of... Who gained in globalization over time? And, you know, I travel with that diagram in my iPad or my computer or, to be honest, sometimes just on paper. And wherever I distribute the diagram, for those who haven't seen it, it's like a highlight of the day. So I of course refer to you, Branko, religiously, but I do kind of take the credit of having that diagram with me and showing it to people who are quite floored by it, because in one diagram you have so much information and such interesting information as to who gained and who lost in the period from 1988 to 2005, I think it is, right?
Right, 2011.
Okay, well, that must be the... There was a first version until 2005?
2008.
Okay, that's it. Okay, Branko, we're all ears for you.
Well, thank you. Well, thank you very much, Kemal. This is a beautiful introduction. I have to thank everybody for coming here on a rainy day. We know that rainy days always cut the audience substantially, but obviously it has not deterred you. So I'm very grateful to all of you. And, of course, I am grateful to Carol and Eduardo for having accepted to be commentators. Now, as Kemal mentioned, I actually do face a double challenge. The double challenge is 10 minutes that I have to speak and without diagrams. So it's actually very hard. And I normally speak for an hour with lots of slides. So I have really to adjust very dramatically. So the way that I decided to do it is actually I would give you a very short sort of a synopsis of aperçu of what the book has. And of course, so that you have a little bit of a feeling whether first you want to buy it or not, or what type of things also you would like to discuss. The book is called, as you know, Global Inequality. So my approach throughout the book is to look basically at the world as a whole, as a single entity. Now, it is most dramatically described in the, you know, graph that actually, that Kemal alluded to, is that that graph essentially takes the whole population of the world, obviously from household surveys from all the different countries, you know, 120 approximately, and then looks at them over the period 1988, which actually happens to coincide with essentially the end of communism, really the joining of China, by China of the international markets. Of course, it happened in even early 80s, but by late 80s, China was really participant there. And also it happens to coincide with the time when India, as we know, 1991 was the crisis in India, and India's policies changed. Up to the period of 2008 and even the update to 2011. Now, the interesting part there, and I will skip many other details, you know, which really go into production of this graph, which is in a paper originally, in a paper that I did with Christoph Lackner, is that when you line up people in the world from the poorest 1%, let's say, or the poorest 5%, to the richest, this infamous global top 1%, then you actually put it on the vertical axis, you look like how much was the real income gain at each of these percentiles over the period of approximately 25 years, which, as we know, coincides with really what you might call the high globalization era. And then what you notice, of course, is that the poorest people have gained, I think it's about 15 to 20% in real terms, but then the gains become stronger and stronger and stronger, and around the median of the global income distribution, and not only median, but really like 20% of people there, so it's really like 1.5 billion people in the world, the gains have become very substantial and reach on average, you know, 100%, in some cases even more. And then what is interesting, then you have a very sudden drop and you come to somewhere about the 80th percentile in the world and the gains become very, very small. You know, 0, 5%, 10%, but they're dramatically less. And then you continue and go all the way to the top 1%. And, of course, there is no surprise. Their gains are very substantial. Again, maybe doubling of real income. Well, the interesting part is then you ask the question, so who are these people who were at what I call the point A, which is this large gains in the middle? Who were the people at point B, which is absence of gains? And who are the people at point C, which are, again, large gains? And not surprisingly, although when the first time I did this graph in June 2012, I was, as Kemal said, I was absolutely also floored. I just couldn't believe that what we knew intuitively does come out in the numbers, is people who are at the point A of large gains, although they are relatively poor, are essentially people in resurgent Asia, let's call it like that. Lots of them from China, obviously, not to the top of the income distribution in China, but the middle, then India, Indonesia, Vietnam, and so on. So much that about 90% of people in that group are from Asia. Then you go to the point B that I saw very little real gain, and there you actually look who is there, and you find that about 75% of the people are people from the rich countries, call it the old OECD, and the lower parts of their income distributions. So these are people who actually saw little gain, and the three countries, because of their size, stand out. It's the U.S., Japan, and Germany. Very little gain in the lower parts of the income distribution. We are talking about single-digit gains in the case of Japan, even negative, and in the case of the U.S., double-digit, but small. I think it was depending on which group, but these are gains between, 12 and 18% or 20%. So that, of course, provoked lots of discussion, and I don't need to tell you what are all the implications, but there were all the issues. Did globalization benefit Asian middle class to the detriment of the rich world's middle class? You can also ask if globalization continues with China being sort of succeeded afterwards by India or Indonesia or Ethiopia in the future, whether that particular pattern of development in the West will continue, and whether that particular pattern of development is compatible with democracy and democratic institutions and so on. Obviously, the rise of Trump did help actually in the sort of making the graph more popular, so I'm actually grateful for that. And then, of course, the last point is the point C, where actually, not surprisingly, we have the large increase in the incomes of the global top 1%. Although that global top 1% is essentially composed of people from the old rich countries. And just to give you an idea, half of the people in that global top 1% are from the United States. So, or putting it differently, 12% of the richest Americans are the part of the global top 1%. Because it's easier to be part of the global top 1% than to be part of the U.S. top 1%. So this is, then you can also raise the issue, like you can see the middle class, if you will, within this graph, the middle class in the U.S., for example, or in France or Italy or Spain or U.K., is being squeezed from two ends, being squeezed on the one hand from cheaper labor in less developed or poorer countries, people who can basically do the same jobs that they can do for much less money, and being squeezed domestically from their own top 1% or the people who have done very well during globalization. So this is really the first part of the book, and I intentionally opened that book with that particular slide, which I described so beautifully now. And I was actually asked by a friend that could I do the same slide for the period before globalization. Now, the issue there is that the data are really incomparably of lower quality. But if I use François Bourguignon and Christian Morrison's numbers, you can do that. And there, what is interesting, you don't find this remarkable sort of sliding scale of gains and losses, not real losses, but really relative sort of losses. But you get really more or less flat line. So in other words, everybody has gained about the same in the period 1960 to 1988. So this is, of course, a dramatic difference now with the period, after the 1960s and up to the globalization today. So this is essentially what is in the first chapter. Since I took so much time, I have to be very sort of quick on the rest. My second chapter deals with inequality within nations. And there is a logic to that because inequality in the world, global inequality, can be conceptually divided into two parts, inequality within nations and inequality between. In the first case, we speak of inequality within the U.S., Mexico, China, India, whatever. In the second case, we speak of gaps in income between U.S. and Mexico or between Morocco and Spain or between Russia and Armenia. And I'm intentionally using the countries where you have large migration because you will see that that's one of the stories in that third chapter. So the second chapter is about inequalities within nations. It is a fairly ambitious chapter because I introduce a sort of modification or development of the Kuznets curve. I actually believe that we are now going through Kuznets waves. I actually use quite a lot of data, not only from the modern times, which I take it from from the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, but even from the pre-modern or agricultural societies of the Middle Age Europe, and to show basically that inequality has historically gone in cycles, and that it was driven by what I call malign and benign forces. I will not now have the time to explain all of them, but benign forces are obviously forces of education, of social legislation, social security, and so on. Malign forces are historically quite well-known forces of war, which generally would lead to the decline of inequality, and had epidemics in the history of the basically European countries and North America. So that's actually the chapter about the Kuznets cycles. Now, the interesting part about that is that actually if you believe then in Kuznets cycles, and I try to convince you that you should, is that you can actually argue that the rich countries are now in the second modern era upswing of the Kuznets cycle. Now, the good news about that is that if there is an upswing now, ultimately down the road there should be a downswing too. But of course I'm very careful about that because I do see currently the forces in the US which rather push towards a further increase of inequality. And then the third chapter is a chapter about the differences in mean country incomes. And the interesting part there is that if you look at the historical data, we have had, it's actually that chapter is kind of, has a cute title, I think. It's called From Karl Marx to Franz Fanon and Back to Marx with a question mark. Because historically, if you look at the world at around 1850, most of inequality in the world, or a significant chunk, maybe about 50%, was due to inequalities within nations. You can call that class. I mean, very sort of under, you know, quotes. Because it's inequality between rich aristocrats and poor peasants or capitalists and workers. And only 50% was due to the differences in the development or income of the countries. Well, you then fast forward to today, you actually have much greater chunk being due to the differences in mean country incomes. Because what happened over the last 150 years, you had rich countries becoming richer and richer, and two very important countries, large countries, India and China, being stagnant or even on a decline. But most recently, within these 25 years, these two countries in particular and others have started catching up. So that the composition of global inequality, if you project it into future, is changing in a peculiar way and bringing us back to something that existed in 1850. In other words, there is a shrinkage of the population weight, the differences between the countries, because of the catch-up of Asia, but there is also the widening of inequalities within nations. So if you were to project that, you could actually see the class element becoming more important in the future, whereas, of course, until, you know, I mean, most of the 20th century and until very recently and still now, it is really the country element which was more important, and hence I used Fanon as a sort of a writer who actually emphasized the difference between poor and rich countries. And just a final note on that, I just saw today, for example, that the World Bank has abolished, which I'm very happy to hear, the term developing countries anymore. So they don't exist anymore because I think it makes sense. It is really becoming more and more difficult to figure out the differences. And somebody was quoted as saying, you know, the difference between Malawi and Malaysia is greater than the difference between Malaysia and the U.S. So it really doesn't make sense to put all the countries in the same sort of a bag. Kemal, do I have, am I over 10 minutes?
No, but you can go on to 3 minutes.
Okay, I can go. Just the last chapter is the chapter that looks at the future of global inequality. And there, I use essentially two forces, not to project it, I don't put real numbers, but to give an idea conceptually. One is the force of economic convergence, which would convert, presumably the mean incomes should converge. And the second is the force of the Kuznets cycles. Now, let me just say like a couple of sentences on each of them. On convergence, I think that so if you look at actually large countries in Asia plus Brazil, and if you look at their growth rate, and even drop China out, in the last 35 years, they have grown faster in every year than the European Union, U.S., Canada, and Japan combined. So in other words, if you take the growth rates of the rich countries versus the growth rate of the populous, poorer countries, for the last 35 years, the poor populous countries have grown faster. So if you really believe that there is something that would actually now happen to change that dynamic, it's very difficult for me to see what it would be. So I'm actually rather optimistic on the convergence front. However, I'm optimistic with a caveat because we don't know what will happen in Africa, and because of the increase of population in Africa, that could be something which actually might change a little bit our rather optimistic story of the convergence of incomes. That's between the countries. Now, when I come within countries, I really discuss essentially US and China. I'm relatively optimistic on China because I believe there are forces there that would actually push inequality down. And if you look at the official data, China has not had an increase in inequality for the last almost 10 years. We have huge problems with Chinese data, by the way, but that's a separate issue. Then for the U.S., I'm less optimistic, and I see in the short run forces that would push inequality up, and I would just list them. One is the rising share of income from capital, which we know has been happening. And second force is the rising concentration of capital ownership, which is actually quite dramatic because the Gini coefficient, people don't talk about that very much, and I didn't actually study it very much either, but the Gini coefficient of income from capital in particularly all rich countries is about between 85 and 90. So that's something which is almost unbelievable. It's particularly everything is concentrated in the hands of very few people. Then the third force is one that actually receives some attention, is that assortative mating or homogamy, although recently I've seen that actually papers arguing that that force was much less strong explanatory factor of rising inequality than was originally claimed. But it essentially means that people of similar educational level, income level, marry each other, and that increases inequality. Number four is an important element which has been recently brought out in a paper by Tony Atkinson and Christoph Lackner, and that's the fact that more and more people nowadays have large incomes both from labor and capital. And that's actually quite striking because nowadays if you're in the top 1% by labor income, you have 80% chance to be in top decile by capital income. So we are talking about new capitalism where, it's not like you can imagine old capitalism. Capitalists were rich, but they had no labor income, and workers were poorer, but they had no capital income. Nowadays, we have top people who have both capital and labor income. And the fifth element is, of course, the importance of money in the political process. Much has been written about that, so I basically only use the results of other people, and I just bring that as another element which makes me pessimistic. So on that rather sort of somber note, and actually I've gone a little bit over my time, I think I would like to finish and obviously to invite, we will now have a discussion. I'm sure some of these questions may be also raised again. Thank you very much for your attention.
Okay, Branko, let me start with two or three points that you make in the book, but there's one question in particular. I mean, one point I think that you make, mm-hmm. but which when I read it again, it's an obvious point, but it kind of, made me, again, concentrate, is that, take a person who has $1 million and a person who has $10,000 annual income, and both have a 10% increase, so one gets another $1,000, the other again, one gets $100,000, okay? The income distribution remains the same between these two, but the absolute increase is 1,000 versus 100,000. So when we look at social phenomenon and political phenomenon and all that, I wonder whether in your research you've come across some that point, because, income distribution as a relative concept is one thing, but the actual gains, when you compare gains, can be overwhelmingly different without changing the distribution. And sometimes I wonder that even at an equal distribution, whether the gains in absolute terms have an impact on Carol Graham's happiness statistics or whatever. That's just a point that you may want to react to it. The real question I want to ask to start the discussion has to do with the Kuznets waves. Mm-hmm. And I may be wrong, because I haven't gone back and reread Kuznets and so on, but I had the feeling that his wave was essentially a wave that was endogenously economic. It had to do with rural-urban migration, with kind of economic forces. Whereas your waves are political economic waves. Am I correct?
You are.
In saying that, and maybe you can elaborate a little bit.
Great. Thank you very much, Kemal. Let me just go over these two questions. The first one, of course, we work always, I mean, we tend to work with relatives. And of course, when I described that, you know, sliding scale of gains and losses, it was all in relative terms. And one has to realize that what is in relative terms for people who are actually making $5 a day is like doubling. In absolute terms, for the rich people, is really sort of peanuts. So they're like a rounding error. But inequality measures, I'll give you a small example, actually. You always are much more alert to these examples when it happens to you. For example, I'm very proud of having like 20,000 followers on Twitter. And the other day I was talking to Paul Krugman, and he says, well, I have, I don't know, 1,540,000 or 1,640,000. And what was the rounding error for Paul was like more than a total amount of followers that I had. So this is the absolute things, you know. And even if we grow maybe by percentage terms the same, I gain one follower and he gains 100,000 or something like that. So that actually our work is always in relatives. And as Kemal said, if you then took a different approach and say, okay, the whole GDP of the world has gone up between 88 and 2011 by 100, who got that 100? And then, of course, you see that about, I think, 47% was gained by the top 1%. So in that sense, the gains were very unequal in absolute terms, even if people in Asia did extremely well. But as I said before, their absolute gains were relatively small if you just look at the part of the additional pie that they got. Now, on the second question, on the Kuznets waves, actually, I'm glad that you asked that. We didn't plan this. But, of course, I can go a long time on that, but it's true. Kuznets had essentially an economic view of the waves, which drives the waves. Or actually, in his case, he only had one curve. He thought that basically, which is reasonable if you are sitting and writing 1960, you thought actually you saw that there was a decline in inequality and you thought the rich countries would become countries with low level of inequality, you know, relatively old population, large social transfers, unemployment benefits. You would not see why inequality would go up again. Which of course provided many problems with the Kuznets curve to start with. In my case, I think actually I see the forces of politics, institutional redesigns, and war actually as very strong forces. I think we were helped to that, to thinking about war, I would say, by Piketty's book. He brings the war really at the center stage. We tended to forget wars maybe a little bit wrongly. And I actually argue, but I will not go into that, but I call it in what I call the, I argue about endogeneity of World War One. I think actually argue that World War One was to some extent precipitated by rising inequalities in the belligerent countries before the war. That's a somewhat old theory of imperialist origins of World War One, but it was only 2 pages in my book. I wrote much more, but actually my editor wisely said, you don't want to have this book a discussion of the origins of World War One because everybody in the world has an opinion on that. So that's not really what is the forte of the book. But I do see political elements as playing much more of a role than in the original formulation. For me, it's a little bit also puzzling that Kuznets, who work actually in the Office of Prices and whatever it's called, which really dealt with the war, really never mentioned the war as an element that really led through taxation in the U.S., of reducing inequality, but maybe I missed somewhere what you wrote.
Thank you, Branko. Carol, I turn to you now to give your comments, questions, perspective.
Okay, well, I'm supposed to be the optimist because I work on happiness, but I'm going to have to try hard to do that. But about the book, I'm very optimistic. This is a terrific book. It's not surprising. Branko has a long line of them. But just a couple of key features. It's just remarkable in its clarity and explanatory power. So the metrics that we use to measure inequality are complex, even this issue of relative versus absolute. The average person can't understand why standard economics wouldn't care that a billionaire gains 100,000 and a poor person gains 1,000, and we don't see that as an increase in inequality. So there are lots of complicated metrics that we use to measure inequality. And Branko does an amazing job in making these accessible to the lay reader, the informed lay reader. For example, we were talking about this earlier. A great example he has in a little box in the book is, well, so what does it mean to be a billionaire? How much money do you have to spend? You know, most of us can't conceive of that. He says, well, if you inherit $1 billion, you would have, and you spent $1,000 a day, which is sort of large by most people's standards, it would take you 2,700 years to blow your inheritance. So that's a lot of money. That's out of the range of imagination for most people. But what Branko does so well is he puts, you know, a real-world element to that. And that's very rare in books written by economists. And I'm one of them, so I confess to be in the same group. The other thing that he does so well is he really weaves in, as he was talking about the wars, a really keen sense of history, of politics, and literature, even in his writing. And so it makes the book a real pleasure to read, in addition to a real learning experience. Now, obviously, I can't cover everything in the book and then also try and say something new in about 5 minutes. So I just want to talk about a couple of key themes in the book and how those link to some new work I've been doing on current trends in well-being and ill-being in the United States. So one key theme is this concept of Kosinitz waves, the curves that Kamal's been carrying all around the world. And so the idea is that rather than seeing inequality as something that first increases with development and then goes away or declines, this waves hypothesis suggests that it's a process that can reoccur and reoccur over time, along with economic, technological, and political changes. So that is a very new element in the discussion of Kosinitz. But it does a great job of describing the situation today. So in today's Kuznets waves, the big winners are the very wealthy in the rich countries and the poor and middle classes in the emerging market economies, particularly Asia. And the biggest losers, in contrast, are the lower middle classes in the rich countries. And the losers in this story are driving two worrisome forces, populism and nativism. And these forces could, in the end, result in a very costly backlash against globalization. And it's something that we're already seeing in both Europe and the U.S. In very heightened political debates. So within this scenario, the U.S. stands out as sort of the poster child for inequality, as the data also suggests. And as Branko just described, we have this perfect storm of inequality. And he described the forces that lead to that, so I'm not going to repeat that, but it is very relevant to what's going on in terms of the backlash in this country. So the perfect storm has already resulted in very worrisome trends. And my work on inequality of well-being in the United States finds some really remarkably stark trends in the data. One example, I'm from Peru and always, you know, grew up thinking the U.S. was a land of opportunity, as many first-generation immigrants do. But the poor in the U.S. today are much less likely to believe that hard work will get them ahead than are the poor in Latin America, significantly so. And when I saw that figure, I was wondering if it was a data miscode or something, and I kept going back to make sure that was correct. And then optimism about the future, which we find in both empirical work and experimental data, optimism about the future is very much linked to people's willingness to invest in those futures. If you believe in your future, you're likely to invest in that future and those of your children. If you don't think you have a future, you know, why bother? What we find is in the U.S., there's no optimism in the future. There's deep desperation among certain groups. And what I think you've increasingly been reading about in the papers today, although I was finding this over a year ago, is that the most miserable and unhappy group and the most pessimistic about the future in the U.S. are poor whites. That surprised me when I first found it. It equally surprised me that poor blacks are the most optimistic of the poor groups. Poor blacks actually score almost a whole point higher on a 10-point future optimism scale. That's a very big change than do poor whites. Poor Hispanics are somewhere in the middle, but poor blacks are very much the most optimistic groups. And these differential views about the future are also playing out in our mortality trends. The U.S. mortality rate is being driven up by preventable deaths among poor and uneducated middle-aged whites. Suicide, opioid and other drug addiction, diabetes, obesity. That is not, blacks and Hispanics are not part of that trend. Their mortality rates have continued to fall. Indeed, black life expectancy, while still lower than that of whites, has narrowed the gap from a 7-year difference in 1990 to just over a 3-year difference now. So you're really seeing this backslide in terms of progress, in terms of optimism, in terms of all kinds of things among poor whites and also near middle class whites. And when you look at what drives these differences in attitudes, I could go on for a long time, but I won't. But the one thing that's, I think, very compelling is that poor and middle income blacks are much more likely to be comparing themselves to parents who were worse off than they were. Meanwhile, poor and blue-collar whites are comparing themselves to parents who had a much more secure existence and much more stable employment. And so the political ramifications of these trends are stark. Donald Trump is clearly one of them, but I think there are also more pockets of racism, nativism, and other political backlashes driven by concerns about downward mobility and falling even further behind. So as Branko describes this perfect storm, it's clear it's not going to go away by itself. And the solutions are deep-seated ones, which aren't readily resolved in political debates like the one we're having now, but they require addressing inequality in endowments up front and not just redistribution ex post. So let's hope, trying to be optimistic here, that as a society we can get past the daunting hurdle of the 2016 elections and begin to think about productive policy solutions. And if there's a good part of the story in terms of how frightening the political debate is, maybe it will produce some sort of wake-up call. And clearly the U.S. is not the only critical player, and this is also occurring in Europe. But clearly, if unhappiness among downwardly mobile Americans drives a major backlash against trade, immigration, and globalization more generally, it's hard to imagine that there wouldn't be a more negative fallout for the rest of the global economy. So I'm going to try and end on a more upbeat note, which is you really have to read this book. It's a great book. And also, hopefully, it will trigger some productive policy thinking in the future.
Thank you very much, Carol. Just one point of clarification, again, about the data we're talking about. And it's particularly, I think, important in the comparison Europe-US. We are basically using household consumption data.
Yeah,
right?
I do. Yes, absolutely. Right. Income, or actually income.
Income, yes. Okay. But income after government transfers.
Right. After government and transfers
taxes.
And taxes.
And
yes.
Taxes.
Yes.
Although some in-kind government transfers may not be there. Like
that's true, actually. In that sense, it underestimates incomes where you have large government-paid health and education.
Health. Yeah. Exactly. But I think it's very important to remember which, you know, what numbers one talks about, because there are the pre-policy numbers, there are the post-policy up to a point, and then you can even go further and try to impute value to
absolutely
things which are not there.
Just for actually people to, maybe some people know, but for example, Piketty size numbers are numbers which are only market income, which means that does not include government transfers and does not deduct direct taxation.
Yeah.
My numbers are actually including both of these elements.
Right. And am I correct in saying that the pre-policy and post-policy difference, while positive in the U.S., I mean, there's
right,
more,
of course, yeah, yeah,
is much larger in Europe.
Yes, it's significantly larger in Europe. Yeah, U.S. is very, I will be very brief, but U.S. is very interesting because it has slightly higher market inequality, underlying inequality than most European countries,
right,
but not dramatically.
That's
higher,
right.
But it also redistributes less. So U.S. actually is kind of more, let's suppose, let's call it moderate, I mean, it has relatively high inequality, underlying inequality, but moderate redistribution. So that's basically what, when you compare U.S. to other rich countries, that's
yeah
what you find.
I mean, the point I'm trying to make here is that it seems that economies that are basically market economies have been able, up to now at least, to redistribute a significant amount from a starting point which was unequal and without too many differences between these market economies. I just wanted to
But I want to say, actually, what Carol mentioned about the endowments, you have a small example of countries that actually have more equal underlying market inequality, and these are Asian countries. And unfortunately, I've got only three of them because there are not that many rich Asian countries. It's Korea, Taiwan, and Japan. They actually, particularly interesting example is Taiwan. They start with relatively low market income inequality. So in order for them to reach the level, for Taiwan, to reach the level of inequality of Canada, they don't need to distribute more than 15% of income. And Canada needs to redistribute 50. So that's really the difference.
Okay. Can I just a quick point about overtime trends in the U.S., which I think are stand out? If you look at what's been going on with redistribution in the U.S. over the same years that inequality has increased so much, but the past two decades, things like TAMF and other aid to the poorest have been falling dramatically. I mean, the charts are very stark. And the language around redistribution has also become very much more divisive. You know, the redistributive programs in the U.S. very much stigmatize the poor, in contrast with programs in Latin America, for example, which do the opposite.
Yeah, that's a good point. So I just want to, let's just always keep in mind what distribution we're talking about, market or after. Now, Eduardo, sorry for breaking in here, but now we're ready for your perspectives, anything you want to, emphasize, and hopefully a little bit also on the political kind of flavors that we perceive these days.
Well, first, maybe I should offer a disclaimer. Unlike my partners here on stage, I am not an economist, not a social scientist. I just play one in a newspaper. So I'm a little intimidated here at my partners here. But I would like to offer some thoughts on Branko's fantastic work. I wrote a piece about your work, I think maybe 3 years ago, about the first time that I encountered your lying down S of the distribution of global incomes. And a question that's been gnawing at me ever since I wrote that piece, and in fact, I think I alluded to this when writing of it, was whether the overall net dynamic that we were seeing was a good or a bad thing. Because this S shows declining inequality between countries, but rising inequality within countries, including at the stage, I think, of your data in China, as in the United States and many other rich countries. And, of course, perhaps what we would ideally like to see, if you're of an egalitarian bent, would be declining inequality everywhere. Given that we had this sort of distribution, I wondered, what could we conclude from a normative point of view? Because there's an interaction between these two things, of course, right? Part of the increase in inequality in the United States has a lot to do with, globalization, technological change that has enabled large shares of production to move to poor countries, which have then have, brought millions of people out of poverty. So there's an interaction between these two phenomena. And it does lead to me a question, is this great? I remember I called Danny Roderick, who said, yes, this is great, because we've decreased the France famine inequality. But written in an American newspaper and read by, the folks at the AFL-CIO, they were like, what do you mean? At the cost of our welfare, this was our welfare, and so we're happy because it helped poor Chinese. So I think that's a really interesting question. I don't have, solutions about it, but I find it interesting. And from that, and yet I wonder whether this combination of dynamics is actually going to continue or not. And you mentioned that you were optimistic about the convergence between countries. And I'm going to, perhaps unfairly profit from the fact that you included Brazil in your list as a proof of convergence. Well, actually, the IMF suggests that between now and 2017 or 18, the Brazilian economy is going to shrink by 10%. Income per capita there is in, fairly bad shape. And if you ask me, is Brazil on the verge of a China? Is there a chance that it becomes a Korea? And I look at how its, how its economy is kind of like very heavily dependent on commodities, very low human capital. I would say not a chance. And so this leads me to a broader thought, which is the idea that the countries that you refer to in Asia that have actually made the leap, Taiwan, Korea, you know, to some extent China, which came from very, very steep poverty into to kind of middle income status, have been based on basically building manufacturers to sell them to the rich world. And there is a good argument to be made that that kind of path is becoming closed to future countries. So if you look at the share of, say, employment in manufacturing across different countries that have developed over different periods of time, amongst the countries that developed very early, you know, like the UK, the United States, Europe, you see very, very high shares of manufacturing employment. And as you move over time, you find that manufacturing employment peaks at a lower level of income. So there's manufacturing employment is giving you less bang, less kind of like economic development bang. And this has been a gradual process that has taken place over decades. So the question to me is, if the path that we knew works is losing a lot of its oomph, what will replace it? And this is a particularly, say, pertinent question for India, which you mentioned. And you know, Prime Minister Modi has suggested that India will have an industrial renaissance. And I think there's good reasons to be very skeptical that that will, in fact, happen. Not only because, you know, China already takes up a large share of the manufacturing, say, space, but also because of technological change and forces like reshoring, bringing manufacturing back to rich countries because you can use more technology and so cheap labor is not necessarily as important. Hence, transportation costs become more important, energy costs become more important, and your distribution of global manufacturing, which benefited employment in poor countries, is now being reorganized in a different sort of way. So that leads me kind of like to be perhaps more pessimistic than you are on the convergence. And on the internal factors, I mean, I would, looking at China today, I would agree with you that perhaps that's a good example of a country that's hitting the down part of the Kuznets curve, where income inequality declines as wages rise more broadly. But pretty much, I mean, everywhere, that's a rare exception. If you ask me, and if you look at, you know, most industrialized countries, and even countries where there has been some decline in inequality, like Latin America, Mexico, where I'm from, and Brazil, I find it very difficult to see what are the forces that, you know, which will need to be sustained over a fairly long period of time that would actually bring inequality down. The United States is perhaps the worst possible place to think about in terms of, you know, reducing inequality, but it's I find it's very important. Well, not only because of the intensity of inequality and the size of the country, but also, I mean, in terms of kind of like perhaps policy lessons that could be shared around the world. And I don't, if you look at the moment that where inequality declined in the United States, which is essentially after the New Deal and World War II, the policy changes that brought this about, which are essentially, you know, new government regulations and a large increase in taxation and redistribution were brought about by a very, very unique circumstance, which was World War II. Even before, you know, before the New Deal, we had the progressive movement, which included a lot of activist government, and the first income tax was passed. We got, you know, the Sherman Act to combat trusts. And even then, the inequality needle moved very little. And it was only when we had this really massive global event that seemed to justify what at the time was called the conscription of capital of the rich in the service of the national purpose, did we manage to reduce the inequality in the country. And so standing here today, I see really no kind of like discontinuity of the magnitude of World War II. Say, not even Donald Trump does that, right? That might actually induce the system to kind of like make the changes in policy that did it in the past. My thoughts are not entirely pessimistic. And I note that you spend some time kind of like speculating on what might be the forces that could reduce inequality again in the United States. And you mentioned that perhaps new technologies that kind of like replace the work of the rich rather than the work of the poor, you know, so pro-poor technological change might be away. You also mentioned other policy changes, like, for instance, perhaps higher inheritance taxes so that you could have a better distribution of wealth, and policies that would lead to better distribution of education, of human capital, so that, you know, we might get into a situation more like Taiwan. And I was going to add one more that I think is potentially powerful and also potentially feasible, which is kind of like reforming the institutions of the market so as to attack what I suspect could be a really big driver of inequality in the United States, and which is economic rent. Now, I mean, I might be overblowing the importance of this, but I think there's a growing body of work that suggests that rents, which, you know, drawn by monopoly power, market power over, you know, certain sectors of the economy, are actually contributing significantly to income inequality. The head of the Council of Economic Advisors, Jason Furman, and Peter Orszag wrote a paper not long ago suggesting that inequality of income, which is the biggest inequality in the United States, which is driving income concentration in the United States, it's not mostly wealth, it's mostly about, you know, your wages, your market incomes, was happening not within firms, but between firms. So there were firms that were paying, that had the ability to pay much, much more than other firms. And so that they suggested, was perhaps evidence of growing rents in the economy that then these firms could distribute to the top very well, and leading to this increasing concentration of income. So my guess is that the politics of redistribution, if you portrayed them as politics to make markets function better, that is, by, you know, reducing market concentration, reducing monopoly power, perhaps affecting things like occupational licensing or better application of antitrust, will be more easily digested by the political system than, you know, a redistributive agenda, even if it's only limited to, like, the inheritance tax, or even to a more egalitarian educational agenda, which we haven't managed to put in place despite decades of ostensible reform. I do think antitrust has a more important role than we might think. And I also think perhaps that the reform of finance could also pack a lot of power in reducing income inequalities. Market concentration in the financial sector, I mean, financiers are amongst one of the big groups in the top 1% and the ones that have benefited of the trend of growing concentration over the last four decades. And I think there is by now a pretty solid consensus in this country that finance needs to be reformed in some way or other. I mean, it brings about crises every three or four years that impose enormous costs on the rest of society. And so the notion that, you know, this sector should not longer be allowed to impose such externalities, or at least should pay for them, is growing. I even heard Larry Summers say this, which wasn't incredibly surprising. And so this, I think, offers an opportunity to address why is it that finance has managed to absorb such a large share of national income, and perhaps, you know, through the regulatory apparatus, through perhaps imposing some price that so that they internalize the negative externalities, might allow for a better intersector distribution of income that could actually make for a more equal distribution in the economy.
Thank you.
Yeah. So there you go. Stop there.
Thank you very much, Eduardo. And I think the issue of monopoly power, I don't know, some of you may have seen Joe Stiglitz's latest Project Syndicate article along those lines, where there are metrics of monopoly power actually having grown quite a bit, particularly in certain sectors like pharmaceuticals and things like that. But I'd like to add one element to that and then give it back to Branko before we open up to the floor. There is also now new technology leads to the ability to price discriminate, which is amazing. I mean, you all know now that depending on the day, the hour, you know, you take a plane, you pay completely different prices. I mean, those of you who are not too young, will remember that 20 years ago there were one or two prices, three prices, you know, and then that was it. I just found out that by changing one day in trying to reserve a flight, you know, it ended up tripling in price. Uber, in a way, is the same model, you know. And when you think about monopoly and market power, while there's something efficient about price discrimination, because every consumer pays like what they're maximally willing to pay, it also absorbs the consumer surplus into whoever does the pricing, okay? And then the big question is, well, why isn't there more market entry? I mean, why is it that Amazon is such a monopoly or close to a monopoly? Or why is it that Google is such a close to monopoly? And I think you've touched on something very important in modern capitalism, that despite world trade, despite globalization, despite the competition from emerging countries and all that, in many sectors, monopoly has dramatically increased, actually. So what does that do to...
But, you know, Kimo, I would stay, actually, because I think we would have lots of policy discussion in a minute. So I would, if you allow me, I would just like to respond to one or two points of Eduardo, not a policy points, because I'm sure we will actually talk more about that. But these are more technical issues. First of all, on the issue of convergence. One thing which is very important to realize sort of at the level of intuition is what we have seen during the last 25 years of globalization is that you can have rising inequalities practically in all the countries, not all, but two-thirds or three-quarters, with global inequality going down. And that's actually sometimes very difficult to sort of have this feeling, but what is really happening is that you really have in each country rising inequality, but there is a catch-up, that's where the convergence come in, between the poor and rich countries, so that dampens the global inequality. So that's very important. Now, why is it also important? It's because it kind of totally, how should I say, sort of colors your view of what is optimistic, pessimistic, because what is optimistic from one perspective is pessimistic from the other. And to give you an example, optimistically we are saying, well, convergence is very good, you know, the poor countries are catching up with the rich countries. Well, the other side of that face of the coin of that convergence is precisely maybe what we are seeing now in the U.S. and the rich countries is that actually middle class is not growing. So there you have an optimistic story in the future. There will be other poor countries that would grow. World poverty is going to go down. Africa will actually start becoming, obviously, not rich, but middle income and so on. So this is all very rosy picture. But because the world is organized in nation states, that rosy global picture, when you translate it at the level of nation states, is much less rosy because in rich countries there is like people who are not growing at all, and in some of the poor countries inequality has really dramatically increased. So that's where this difficulty comes in, is that you have to keep at the all the time these two different, like juggle with these balls, and which really tempers your own view to view everything in a sort of rosy colors or to view it in only very, very dark ones. On a second point on these Kuznets waves, I actually do believe that actually Brazil and China provide very good sort of examples for my story because I actually see both Brazil and China being at the peak and actually Brazil on the downslide of the first Kuznets wave. And actually, to some case, Brazil is almost poster child for the Kuznets waves because the movements that have happened in the last 15 years which reduced inequality in Brazil are really increasing education, reduced wage premium of the highly educated people, a higher minimum wage, which is exactly the result of social pressures or maturing of population, greater redistribution, and, of course, large social transfer programs. So it's actually Brazil really fits it almost, I would say, perfectly to the extent that real numbers can fit kind of some, you know, abstract concept. And there I see China also entering that stage, despite corruption and huge differences between provincial incomes and so on, there is a push towards introduction of much more social transfers than currently they are basically limited to state-owned enterprises, but there is really push for that. And there is also finally the end of the Lewis type of growth with unlimited supply of labor at a constant wage rate. So, you know, that's why I think both China and Brazil as being good examples of my Kuznets waves. And just to clarify, they would be like down, going down the first peak, but the U.S. and the rich countries are actually going uphill on the second wave. So that's where I see them as being. Now, obviously, that's not going to fit exactly every country, but if it fits about a dozen large countries, I would be very happy.
Okay, let's open it to the floor. Jed, you raise, and then the lady next. Yeah, first Jed. We'll take two or three.
I'm Jed Schilling, and
we'll take two or three questions at once, and then go back.
Okay, well, I have one quick comment and two quick questions. The comment with what Carol was saying about looking at different percentage, in, you know, the same percentage increase at different levels, is one concept that doesn't get a lot of attention in economics, is declining marginal value of money. If you're a poor person making $10,000 a year and get an extra $1,000, it's incredibly valuable because you can finish feeding your family and do a lot of other important things. If you're a millionaire and get an extra $10,000, you probably don't even notice it. And it's not clear that it's increasing your welfare. So more money that goes into the bottom level, even if it's a lower percentage, is going to have a better impact on improving the welfare of the people, not just the incomes. Then a couple of questions. To what extent can you take account of the technological revolution in looking at income distribution? Because the Industrial Revolution created lots of jobs and brought up the lower class. The technological revolution that we're having now is not creating as many jobs, but creating a lot of wealth at the top, and with robotics is eliminating a lot of the working class jobs, which also contributes to the slower growth of the income of the middle and lower classes in the United States, because many of the good manufacturing jobs are lost to robots here, not to people working in China. So how that is taken account would be useful. And then the other thing, going beyond the concern about the rent that's going on and the monopolies, is what I characterize as paper assets, where you now have in the quasi-financial sector these derivatives and lots of other assets that create lots of value and people make lots of money trading, but there's no real production based on that capital. It is just what I call paper capital, and a lot of the people in the finance sector are also making large amounts of money trading daily or every 2 seconds, depending on how they can do it. So you're getting a lot of that level of income that is not, doesn't correspond to creating anything real for the economy the way income is supposed to do that. So that's another factor I don't know if you can take into account in looking at why and the kinds of income inequality you have.
Thank you. Yes.
Okay, so I'm just going to totally toss in another variable to discuss, but especially in light of like talking about China and India, I feel like it's impossible to not also consider climate change and sort of like climate change brought by a lot of manufacturing. My question is whether you envision different proposed solutions to climate change to be a sort of boon or like a potential solution also to inequality or perhaps another perpetuation of inequality.
Thank you. Bringing in another big topic into, yeah, anybody? Vito.
There is another question.
And then, yeah. We'll take also you afterwards.
I just published a book, and the title of the book, From Economic Miracle to Stagnation. And in Italy had 30 years of growth, and then the down to 2.1% in the last 10 years had been about 0%. The same thing happened to Germany, the same thing happened to Japan, the same thing to some extent happened to Korea. And so why this will not happen in China and in India? Because as this country grow, the rest of the world becomes smaller. So the export that they are, you know, they are doing would be much more difficult for the rest of the world to absorb them. So are we sure that really this trend will continue, or what is the view? No, that I would be very skeptical that I also wrote a book on China, by the way, and I'm very skeptical that the Chinese will keep growing at this rate, assuming that the rate that we normally measure is the correct one. I have lots of questions about that.
Thank you. Yes?
Thank you. Could you advise, may I ask, how do you see the relationship between the political mechanism and the income inequality? I mean, for example, how do you see the difference of the income inequality between democratic countries and the non-democratic authoritarian countries? Do you think that the democratic countries are better in mitigating income inequality because of its function to redistribute income through taxation? Thank you very much.
Well, with that, you have another 5 hours of...
Yes.
I mean, not just yours, but, you know, climate change, convergence, growth. Anyway, pick.
But I would actually be very brief, because actually many of these issues, of course, they're extremely important, but, you know, this is just one book, and it's a book which actually deals with global income. And basically what one needs to realize, there is only one variable there, and that variable is income. Now, that does not address questions like what Jed asked, for example, labor. You know, that would be another book, or somebody else should write that book. So obviously the two industrial revolutions, I would go back a little bit in order, industrial revolutions were different, and I'm not totally convinced that actually that the only way to develop is through production of things. I actually believe that we have gradually moved from agricultural societies, because essentially our needs were food to textiles to things, and then to services. So this is not something which is universally accepted. People still believe that development is basically manufacturing, but I'm not quite sure that in the future we would see it the same way. But anyway, on labor, on jobs, I don't have much there. Similarly, what you called, was it fictitious capital or I don't know? Paper. I think Marx called it fictitious. I don't have much about that either, because obviously these are like sub questions of this big global question, which basically works with, as I said, one variable, which is income. Now, on the same thing, unfortunately, applies to climate change. So I can actually discuss with you that, but as an informed observer, but it's not something that I've studied and it's in the book. Now, going to Vito's question, I'm looking at that from the global perspective. It does not require for me, for global inequality to go down, that China continues growing at 8%. And actually, China is a very interesting case, because China is now reaching the level where it's maybe even now, 2016, at the level where its growth adds to global inequality. China is now about to become a global inequality disequalizer, because it has been relatively become rich. But it is sufficient that other countries grow at the rate which is higher than the growth rate of the rich world. And on that, I would actually take a bet for the next 10 years that the rich countries are going to grow at a lower rate than these five countries which exclude China that I have in my book, and which are actually, I think, Indonesia, India, South Africa, Brazil, and Vietnam. And I would take a bet really of like 50-1 that these five countries are going to grow faster. And if they grow faster, that's a sufficient force to reduce global inequality. So in that sense, I'm optimistic. Now, as I said, I don't think China will continue at 8%, nor will Vietnam, but they would continue maybe at 4.5, whereas Europe would be at 0, so that would be still, you know, reduction of global inequality. And one final point I want to mention, before the democracy and totalitarianism, one final point, when you also look at this global inequality, there was a nice idea of that John Romer had, and we had a small paper on that, is that actually if you make a welfare function, going back to utility, which doesn't have only your income, but has your income in relative terms to the mean of your country, and then you play with the parameters, there is at one point where your perception of inequality is rising, because you're really basically only comparing yourself to your own country, and you don't really care that the global inequality is going down. So it's a very tricky part, and that might explain why many people believe that inequality is going up, because that's what they observe. They don't really look at inequality, you know, in Zambia or, you know, China or elsewhere. And so finally on, I don't have any, I mean, this is really, I can sort of think about that there are papers that show that democracies are better for inequality. But then, that was, of course, the Acemoglu-Robinson point of view. But then they remarkably leave out, actually, communist countries, which I think was a mistake, because they were actually countries with totalitarian governments and with low inequality. So you cannot just take it was at some point whatever one third of the mankind and say, well, it doesn't really matter for my model. So I'm not really sure about this, but I would tend to believe that, of course, democracies are better for redistribution, but it's not really some empirical work that I've done.
Any additions to these comments? We'll have another round. But
I again, not being a social scientist, I don't have to have studied it very seriously to be able to comment on it. So I will take on the climate change question. Which I've written a little bit about. I mean, I think at first order, you'd have to think that the climate change, the inability to use fossil fuels, which were the thing that powered economic development for, you know, the entire period of history since the Industrial Revolution, the fact that that's going to become much more expensive will hurt poor countries more than it hurts rich countries who can make transitions to more expensive renewables and so on. The first order is less access to energy to countries that really most desperately need energy. I think that is the overriding impact of the current moment. It could be addressed through transfers. There is, you know, this big $100 billion a year kind of promise to developing countries to help them pay for this transition. I'm not sure that this money will materialize or that it is enough. I think that in the global warming worried community, there is a bit of a misunderstanding of the magnitude of the energy needs in poor countries. So you get people talking about distributed solar in Africa as a solution, like, say, a solar panel on every hut. A solar panel will not power an iron. And if what, you know, Zambia needs is a refrigerated plant for, you know, where, you know, thousands of people can work in the hot summer, distributed solar is really not going to do the trick. So I think that as a really worrisome, I mean, global warming is worrisome for a variety of reasons, but I think including the impact it has on inequality around the world.
Errol?
I just wanted to, I have thought a little bit about this democracy and redistribution question, although it's, as Branko mentions, it's very difficult to answer because you can have authoritarian governments like the former Soviet Union that redistributed too much to a point that it was just not productive. You can have democracies with populists that redistribute to the point that they mess up the macroeconomy for years to come with huge costs to the poor. And then you can have democracies like the European ones where there's basically a consensus on how the state should operate, how much, you know, citizens are protected by the state. And then you have democracies like the United States where there's a very strong anti-redistribution sentiment and reality in among much of the political establishment, which you could argue means we haven't redistributed enough to reduce inequality. So my hunch, like Branko's, is that democracies on better are better forms of government and better in reflecting citizens' preferences, but they're not always efficient, and sometimes citizens' preferences can vary tremendously across societies, and then you'll get very different inequality outcomes, not because of the kind of government, but what's sort of the norm about redistribution.
Let me add one thing on Jed's point, because when I gave the example, I was thinking of the diminishing marginal utility in a way counter-argument, but I think it's an interesting, and if anybody, you know, broader issue, including the Rawlsian thing that's in your book, but you can have a view of the world. These are, at the end of the day, value judgments, where, you know, from an ethical point of view, what matters is if basic needs are taken care of, okay? And in that sense, obviously the world has made tremendous progress. I mean, the world 100 years ago was a much worse place in terms of basic needs of human beings than it is now, no question about it. And then, in a sense, as you know, the rest is almost irrelevant. I mean, the kind of conservative political arguments will say, well, who cares if the guy has, you know, $1 trillion income? What does it matter? I mean, it doesn't harm anybody. And so, there, you know, you can put it that way. The,
The other side, however, I think is the political economy side. Another $10 or $1 to a very poor person compared to another few millions can have politically hugely different impacts. In other words, if your metrics is political influence and power rather than marginal utility of consumption, you could get a very different kind of perspective on that. And one could argue that that in terms of what creates the political debate and the political tension, it's much more the latter these days than the former. But, so, I mean, I think it's a valuable point, but I think it's more complicated than just diminishing marginal utility. Why don't you say one thing about the Rawlsian, the two Rawls's books, I mean, The Theory of Justice and The Theory of Peoples, because it goes to Eduardo's point about what's so bad about the fact that we have this, you know, broad convergence, even though within nations there's increasing inequality. And you address it in the Rawlsian debate.
Yeah, I'll try to be brief because it's a very contentious point, and of course I have to tell you that's one of points that maybe many people would disagree with. But when you really look about inequality in the world, this Franz Fanon situation that we still are living through, it raises really two very important issues. One, what I call global inequality of opportunity. In other words, that actually the same person born in a rich country has multiple, by order of magnitude, higher income than the same person born in a poor country, which raises a political philosophy issue that political philosophers like Rawls have dealt with. And that actually is an issue that has to be brought to the table, because when we speak of inequality of opportunity, implicitly, we only take nation state as our reference. So the question actually can be asked, does really inequality of opportunity end at the national border? And it's a very important question in terms of political philosophy, and Rawls believed that it was the case for the reasons that are long to explain, but basically that there was no compact or you know, the famous veil of ignorance that actually is placed in front of all the citizens in the world, but that each country does it separately. And that may not be something that in a global world we really sort of necessarily have to believe anymore, but that's an important issue. The second problem that is raised by that is the issue of migration, because I really would like to see migration, I make a big point of that, as part of globalization and global inequality, and as very potent tool for the reduction of global inequality and for the reduction of global poverty. So that really raises all these issues, and the controversial part is there that actually I suggest that actually that we, if we want to keep that tool working, we have to accommodate the willingness or reluctance of the native populations to allow more migrants by sort of allowing for different status or different statuses, in plural, if this is the correct plural, of migrants. So that's a very controversial issue, because it essentially means that not every migrant can immediately claim or expect to get citizenship and the right to stay in that country forever. And to put it very bluntly, it is moving us maybe towards some kind of a combination of the West European and the Gulf state models. Not that the Gulf state model is a good one, but it actually, it has an advantage that people go there, make money, send this money back, and make people in India and Bangladesh richer. So that's an advantage, despite the fact that people are discriminated and treated very badly.
Super controversial, but anyway, no. I think Eduardo wanted to say something, and I.
Oh yes, I just wanted to. Should we? The question.
Yeah, briefly. Yeah.
You know, the idea of how inequality interacts with democracy is also an interesting point that you actually address at some length in the book, and you know, inequality affects the character of the democratic regime, and so you propose that it'll drive it into an either a plutocratic equilibrium, where you know the plutocracy that controls the wealth and power essentially uses this wealth and power to you know continue with this kind of like unequal distribution of income, and so that essentially traps the country in a certain level of inequality, or actually makes it increase, or in a populist equilibrium, which might be characterized by what we see in some countries in Europe, these days, where again, there's really no improvement in inequality. I mean, the democratic institutions do not actually lead to more redistribution and a diminishing of inequality, but actually are captured by different forces that, in fact, entrench the inequality that's there. So democracies are clearly not like spectacular tools in any in every instance.
So I just want to try to take people who, Vito, I mean, is it very, very brief? Because I there's a gentleman there who hasn't talked. Okay, please, yeah, in the back.
Hi, my name is Mohammed. Thank you very much for the interesting presentation. So the first one, in your book, you are talking about reducing inequality, but not really achieving equality, right? So that's the first one. Because, like, in our perspective, we want to reduce inequality, but we don't want equality at the end of the day. So that's the first one. Second one, who should be handling the or tackling the issue of inequality? Is it markets or governments? Don't you think that a governmental intervention to reduce inequality will result in increasing poverty? Thank you.
Can I do very briefly on that? On the first one, you know, it's very important. It's not, we are not talking about two discrete things. It's not like either you have inequality or everybody has the same income. Inequality is like a continuous variable. So you can be high inequality, medium inequality, less medium inequality, and so on. Government versus war, you know, this is a perennial debate. I believe both have a role, so I would like to leave it at that.
Vito, very quickly.
Issue which has been mentioned is the question of migration. You know, I mean, the most fundamental role of a state is to protect frontiers. As long as people come through the official channels, you can protect frontiers. But when the thousands and thousands come through the sea, then you have a question of civil rights against national rights. It becomes very, very difficult to stop these people. Now we have a situation where we have billions of people who potentially could move in this way in very small areas. Well, that's the greatest, really, challenge to the world that we know. I don't know what is going to happen, but I'd be curious to have some reaction to that.
Anybody else who wants to come in at this point? Okay, quick.
Yeah, when I was talking about the technical industry's impact on jobs, I wasn't talking just about manufacturing jobs, but the bulk of income most people get comes from working. But the technology has shifted that to creating a small number of high-income jobs in the financial sector has, and then leaving more low-income jobs in the service and other sectors. So that shift in the kind of jobs is having an impact on income equality.
Right. Can I take them very, very briefly? On Vito's, actually, I totally agree. I think it's the challenge of the next 100 years. If you look at the numbers, Africa is going to have four times as many people as Western, basically EU, in 50 years, or actually at the end of the century, sorry. So that's really, it's a huge challenge. I mean, these people are going to come and to multiply their incomes by 10 times, and, you know, Europe is not ready to accept them. So I totally agree. On this other point...
Europe or anywhere else.
Or anywhere else, yes, exactly. That's why I think it's very important to think of migration, not something which really fell from the sky, but within the context of global inequality and inequalities between the countries. Then on services versus manufacturing, actually I show I have a sort of nice results for the U.S. where actually obviously inequality within services has increased much more in wages because they are very heterogeneous. Then in manufacturing. Moreover, there is, I think, one very important implication. Services are such that actually you have small units and they are dispersed. You cannot have labor force organized in trade unions, and that's one of the reasons why trade union density is declining, because you don't have like any more big plants with 5,000 workers in one place. You have hundreds of units, one which is in the U.S., another is in India, third one is in Africa. So I think there are many implications there. And moreover, of course, if you don't have trade unions, then you have an issue of the rents, so the workers are losing out, and inequality goes up on that account as well.
We'll take one last round. Just one thing. Branko and I are going to a conference when you said the primary role of a state or a nation is to protect its borders. But the title of the conference we're going to in summer is Why Do We Have the Nation State? So in a sense, you could, why are there these borders? I mean, are they particularly legitimate, particularly God-given, nature-given, whatever? I'm just saying from a philosophical point of view, of course we need the nation state. But I think the question you raise, I agree, is the biggest, one of the biggest questions for the century, because in this globalized world, what is it that allows, and don't think of Italy, think of a small Gulf sheikdom that by not accident of history, but imperial design of, you know, of Britain, let's say, is sitting on trillions and trillions of wealth, okay? And somehow, because it is a nation state, has the right to tell the Yemeni or the Pakistani immigrant that she or he doesn't have the same opportunity, right to opportunity. So I think it's even more complicated than you said, Vito. But anyway, last round. We start with just last few comments, if you have any.
Oh, yes. Indeed. One of the questions that I've grappled with unsuccessfully, of course, is how does this, in the American context, how does this end? And what is the political moment that brings it to an end? And I described it was, well, when does the American Jacobin moment happen? Is there a moment that these inequalities, which after have rebounded so sharply from the Great Recession, and seem to be now going even higher than they were in 2007. Is there a moment when this makes the political system explode? Reading Branko's book, and when he was describing this this plutocratic system that can evolve from these kind of inequities, it kind of perhaps clarified my thinking and made me wonder whether you get to a point where the plutocracy, in order to defend the system from the pent-up dissatisfaction, anger, and whatnot, finally concedes that inequality has gotten too high. Now, this is pie-in-the-sky, sort of like Snow White-type thinking, but when I look at the fact that Donald Trump is there and the challenge that he's imposed to the Republican orthodoxy, which is basically a low taxes and increasingly lower and lower tax sort of economic policy, and Trump comes with a mixture, with a grab bag of ideas that includes things like maintaining Social Security spending up, and includes perhaps, I mean, depending on what day he's speaking, it might include increasing the minimum wage. You can see, and it's also wrapped in extremely, racist and xenophobic and so on arguments as well. You can see that the Republican orthodoxy could feel threatened enough, perhaps, to change or to, open some space for increased redistribution, for, I don't know, somewhat bigger EITC, for, the kind of policies that might at some point mitigate, at least at the margin, the increasing growth of concentration of income. I mean, it's me grasping at straws, frankly. So I realize that you could really easily slap this argument down as crazy. But, I do wonder whether that is a dynamic worth considering.
Carol?
Well, lots of different thoughts, but going back to the nation state and immigration point, I think one thing that, we sort of were stuck with nation states, but their nature may be changing. But on the immigration point, we have this model where we assume that everybody that migrates wants to come and be American. And so either come, they get full rights, and then if they don't, they can't leave. They're stuck here. Maybe they want to leave. Maybe they want to come and work a while and go home to wherever they're from. But that sort of either you migrate illegally and you are stuck in a nation state you may not want to be in, you may not even want to be a citizen of, you may just want to work, versus other people want to come and be citizens. And even when you think about the great migration crisis now in Europe, I mean, I'm sure plenty of Syrians would love to go back to Syria if there were ever peace there. You know, it's not clear that they want to be Danish. And so it strikes me that this sort of the kind of very rigid nation state management, I mean, nation states have a right to manage who comes in and out of their countries, but that this kind of, it's still very locked in sort of black and white terms, and I think it is a time we should be thinking about it differently, both because of inequality and because it's such a huge crisis, global crisis.
And Branko touches it. I mean, we may agree or not with his policy prescription, but he definitely touches on this in the book. Branko, last word.
Well, last word, because we were on that, you know, and we knew the migration would become a big topic, so Kemal and I agreed that we would just bring it at the very end, because it's a book not about migration. Migration is only within that, sort of scheme of things of global inequality. But, you know, what I actually just ask somebody who disagrees with me is to acknowledge that there is a trade-off between giving all the rights of citizenship, which entail not only voting rights, but obviously working rights, rights to social security and everything else that the citizen has, there is a trade-off between doing that and willingness to accept migrants. Once you agree that there is a downward sloping line, there is a trade-off, that if we give native population gives less rights, they will be more open to having more migrants, then everything else follows. We can agree at which point we should draw the line, but I actually think that we need to re-examine the idea of citizenship as a binary category, which is either zero, that you're not a citizen, we don't care about you, or you are one, you're a citizen, you have all the rights. Once we actually accept to re-examine that, then I think we will actually maybe agree. Different countries will put the equilibrium point at different, equilibrium at different points. But we would actually really move towards using migration as a tool for reduction of global poverty and global inequality, and making it compatible with the acceptance of the local populations. Because if native populations don't want migrants, then this big tool of the reduction is just going not to be used.
Thank you very much, and I think this gives me an idea to try to organize a event like this with the title Multiple Identities, Different Levels of Nationalities.
Yeah,
how
that's
about
true.
That?
That's a good one.
Anyway, thanks a lot for coming. Thanks, Branko, for doing this here,
thank
and thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.